Arm Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast here to share a winning strategy for Father's Day from our partners at Sterling Roastery. If your dad treats his morning coffee like a pregame ritual, you need to introduce him to the Sterling Roastery lineup. This isn't that stale, over-roasted stuff sitting on our grocery shelf. Sterling roasts their beans multiple times a week for unbeatable freshness. The smart play? A coffee subscription. He gets to choose his grind, from French press to espresso, and his favorite roast, depth. It's a world-class lineup of Java that shows up like a reliable veteran on a perennial powerhouse team. Go to sterlingsoap.com and set him up. He'll thank you with every cup. That's sterlingsoap.com.
As modern gridiron fans, we might take the geometry of the football field for granted. The crisp white numbers, the directional arrows for TV viewers, and the standard 10-yard intervals. But as football historian Timothy Brown reveals, the field wasn't always a masterpiece of clarity. In the early days of the sport, the players, fans, and officials were often literally lost on the field. Imagine trying to officiate a 25-yard penalty on a field that didn't have identified lines and numbers to help navigate the penalty. Tim joins us to break down how the chaos of the early field experimentation eventually gave way to the standardized markings that define the game's field today. Hello, my football friends. Once again, we are joined by Timothy Brown of footballarchaeology.com to bring us one of his tidbits that he's done recently. Tim, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Hey there. Look forward to chatting. And I think this podcast should work very well in digital format.
In digital format, yes. We're going to be talking a little bit about that as we go through a little bit of history here, because you had a tidbit that you wrote recently that really tweaks my officiating side of me. The evolution of yardage markers and field numbers is what you called it. These are things that I'm very familiar with, and I'm sure everybody watches football is. So what can you tell us about this history?
Yeah. I distinguish yardage markers and field numbers as, you know, I just view yardage markers as signs along the grandstands, or, you know, the posts. There's a little rubber tripod and trapezoidal things that, you know, have, you know, been on football fields over time. And then field numbers are the actual, you know, they're some kind of number or indicator painted on the field, on the grass or on the turf, you know, itself. So just for that. So I think, you know, the thing about the numbers that, you know, just to kind of put them in place, one of the things that it kind of shocks me every time when there's certain images of old football fields in the non-checkerboard days, when you look at the, you know, it's a big old stadium, and you get a shot from, you know, press box or higher, and the field is just barren. You know, all that's there is the sidelines, the goal lines, you know, later on the end lines too, and the yardage lines. And, you know, so no lock knee lines, no hash marks, no numbers, no logos, all that kind of stuff. And, but then obviously that's changed a lot over time. So I just, that's kind of where I'm coming from with, you know, the story. But, you know, in before we had, you know, field numbers and even some of the yardage markers, about the only really things that they had on the field, sometimes they'd have the 25-yard line was a bigger deal back in the day, because that's where the, you did kickouts, you know, before they had touchbacks, and or even with touchbacks, and, you know, safeties were kicked from the 25. So oftentimes the 25 was had some kind of diamond chalked on it or something like that. Sometimes the center line was a little bit different, either the 50 or the 55. In, you know, starting about 1900, they started hanging these signs on along the, you know, the kind of the base of grandstands. But then, you know, a lot of times, like, the players would block, you know, people couldn't see them because players were down there, you know, people on the opposite side of the field. So then they started putting posts or, you know, different kinds of, basically different forms of signs, maybe 5 yards off the yard line or off the sideline. So that's about all they had. And then in 27, when they moved the end line, or I'm sorry, when they moved the goalpost to the end line, there's a whole flurry of activity because everyone was concerned that players, fans, officials would be confused about where the goal line is, because they had always known the goal line was where the goalposts were. But once you shift them back, it's like, well, where's the goal line? Mm-hmm. So, you know, pretty much all across the country, people tried different things to, you know, they put dummies and whatnot on the goal lines. Some people actually stuck little pieces of paper on sticks along the goal line. But like painting diagonal stripes or checkerboards in the end zone was probably the most common thing. And, you know, basically our whole concept of decorated end zones, that originated in 27 because we moved the goalpost to the back line. So, you know, there's all that stuff going on. And there may have been a few schools that in 27 painted either a zero on the field itself or a G, you know, right at the goal line. Mm-hmm. But over time they started painting numbers on the field, typically every 10 yards. Some did it every 5 yards and still do, but they were like all shapes and sizes. You know, I think the tidbit has an example. It's actually from the Canadian Football League, but, you know, just these really long, you know, elongated numbers that just look strange, you know. But there were other schools that had like the numbers inside of a box, and the box might be a red box with the numbers. You know, it was just kind of all kinds of different things. And so it kind of didn't matter, you know, what you did. Because it was at that point, it was intended for the fans and they could figure it out, you know, the fans in the stands. But over time, it became a little bit bigger deal because, you know, with television audiences, then the networks kind of wanted a little bit more regularity in terms of where these numbers showed up and what they look like. But the real push came from coaches. So, you know, wide receivers are often taught to run their patterns in relationship to the field numbers. And, you know, you run this pattern on the outside of the field numbers or on the inside, or you force the defender to the inside, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, but if the field numbers are different at every field, then your coaching points no longer work. So the NFL in 72 said, okay, we're going to standardize these things. Every field has to have the same size, location of the field numbers. And those have changed a little bit from time to time. And in 78, they added the directional arrows on the field as well, which, again, helps the TV audience, you know, more than, you know, even if you're in the stands, at least you can tell it's on that side of the field, right? You know?
Right. I'd hope so.
Yeah. And then, you know, NCAA required their numbers, you know, to be standard format in 82, though they've never required the directional arrows. But, you know, a lot of schools have them. So anyway, it's just one of those things that, you know, it just reminds you that, you know, it's just another instance of things like, and with the field, especially this way, I guess equipment too, you know, people create their own way of doing things, right? And then it gets to a point where, for one reason or another, they say, okay, we got to standardize this. Everybody's got to do it the same way. And so this is just one of those instances of kind of a, you know, groundswell activity that just developed organically that then becomes standardized and consistent. Right. So.
And I know, at least high school wise, the National Football Federation has them at the 9 yard marks, they call them. And that's indicated, that's by a rule too, for substitution in between every play, every player for that next play has to be inside the numbers at some point during, the time in between snaps. So, and ready for play. So that's that's a good rule that they use there. So we always would use the numbers and refer to, you know, inside the numbers or top of the numbers and do that too. So that was good. And it makes
That takes care of, you know, the old lonesome end kind of.
Right.
You know, trick plays and all that.
The guy just hanging out like he's talking to the coach and all of a sudden he goes down for a, you know, long pass. Yeah, that's exactly what that the substitution rule is for. And it also takes me back when I first started officiating. I was in my early 20s and I got on a really good crew. They had a really experienced crew. We had a gentleman that was probably about 45 years older than me. So he's in his mid-60s at some point. And he was a ball buster. You know, he busted my chops all the time, but in fun, you know, in jest. And he always had something to say, and he didn't quiet him down very, very often. So he was our umpire. So one time I did quiet him down. We were talking, he was getting on my case a little bit, and we were talking about something about the numbers. And I told him, I said, Ed, I said, you know, when you started, you know, they had Roman numerals on the field when you started playing. And he didn't know what to say. He just shut up for a little bit and started laughing. He's like, okay, you got me there. But he's no longer with us, but it's always a memory I have of old Ed and good guy. So we had a lot of fun.
Yeah,
folks, they never had Roman numerals on the field.
Well, probably someplace did. Furman, when they had Dad Amos, before the jersey numbers got regulated, he put his team out there. You know, they had to have numbers, so he put them out there with Roman numerals.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's a great story. And it's great to hear about that. And you learn a little bit about the evolution of the game and how, you know, how the forefathers of football are sort of thinking and tweaking things as rules come up or somebody does something innovative, and they have to be innovative with the markings on the field and field equipment too. So that's great stuff. And you do this a lot in your tidbits, and maybe you could share with people how they could partake in some of your tidbits.
Sure. Just go to footballarchaeology.com. You can either, you know, if you use Substack for other purposes, you can follow or you can subscribe, in which case you'll get an email every time that I issue a new story. So and that will contain the full story itself. But otherwise, just bookmark it and go out and check out Football Archaeology whenever the need arises.
All right, Tim. Well, we really appreciate you sharing this with us today, and just like you do each week, and we would love to hear another story next week.
I bet we will get a chance to talk. All righty. Thank you.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hi, everyone. There's a new podcast in town, Statman and Robin. We are the dynamic duo of Baltimore sports history.
We have lots of stories to tell about the great and not so great teams and players in Baltimore's rich sports history, and some of the more obscure ones too.
We grew up together with these teams and players, and we'll add our experiences to these great stories.
Yep, we were there for a lot of them. Join us here on the Sports History Network.